Just before we get started, I want to know who thought up the title for this talk? Who was that? That was you thought of that. How to spend money and feel rich about it. Okay, good. I like interesting topics, so it's good. I take it you're all students here, or nearly all students here. Right?
Nope.
Okay, so you're practicing your... Is anybody doing psychology? No psychologists? Who's doing engineering? Okay. So I guess that future Buddhism is going to be found in engineering. So I myself am a... psychologist is my kind of background, which I studied in Thai University, in Thai, actually, and I'm quite proud of that. I know for some of you, English is your second language, but believe me, your English is better than my Thai. And so, as she also mentioned in the introduction, I also teach in my university, and sometimes I like to get very technical with the nature of the mind and the nature of Dharma, and I really love to use stories in the way that we can analyze the mind for particular reasons, which I won't go into this evening unless you ask me to. But I'm also aware that sometimes, while I'm getting all technical and into details, sometimes I do these really good Dharma talks, really specific and precise, and then at the end of it, people can ask questions, and they ask me things like, how long have you been a monk, and where do you live? So, and I can forget the basics sometimes. So if you'd like to go back to some of the basics, where did I ordain and why did I do that, then you're welcome to ask questions on those topics at the end. This topic that you so adroitly gave to me is a subject about desire, and the nature of desire, which is something that has intrigued psychologists in the last 100-odd years. And generally speaking, in psychology, we call desire motivation. And there's a slight difference in the connotation, which I will mention. Desire also has been the topic of many great works of literature. And, for example, do you know Parsifal, Wagner's last opera? Nobody knows that. Wagner was a student of Buddhism. Not a great student of Buddhism, I have to say, because he's German. I think that's the reason. And the Germans were very... His teacher was Schopenhauer, and Schopenhauer... I'm not an expert on these people, so don't ask me questions about these people. I'm not well known, but Schopenhauer and these guys, when they were studying Buddhism in Germany, hit upon this idea that you have a rebirth from death to birth, from death to birth. But enlightenment is a complete and utter suicide, so that you never get reborn. And the Germans love this idea, like just obliterate your soul. And this is how they understood Buddhism. And a very good friend of mine, he still thinks like this. He's Austrian. And it's almost the same as German night there. Wagner's last opera was then, Wagner being a student of Buddhism, he wrote this opera about enlightenment. And even though the story is about the Holy Grail and the Christ and the cross of Christ, the story actually is about Maitreya Buddha and the overcoming of suffering through the nature of desire. And so I was suggesting that if you guys want to do a play on this topic, this would be a really good topic to do a play on. Maybe not this year, but next year. And then I could come and help you with that. Especially since the play is already written for you. That kind of helps. This story actually is called The Fisher King, and it goes back thousands of years and has been retold in many forms. So the nature of desire is key. The nature of desire is key to the practice of meditation and key to the path of enlightenment. For many people and many religions and many philosophies, it's quite easy to see that greed, hatred, delusion, jealousy, anger, all of these are negative states of mind. And for most people around the world, we can recognize that these are unwholesome states of mind. And one exercise I often do with different groups all around the world, in different groups around the world, and sometimes I talk to strange groups and different people, students and business groups sometimes. And one exercise that we sometimes do is I ask the audience to name unwholesome qualities. And it doesn't really matter who the people are. They may be Christian, they may be atheist or secular, they may be Buddhist. They may not know what they are, but most people agree on what negative qualities are. Anger and jealousy and greed and these kind of things. Stress, maybe. And then I also ask, what are the positive qualities? And most audiences also agree on positive qualities. Love, kindness, patience, forgiveness, mindfulness. These tend to be listed by people as good qualities. And I find it very interesting that actually pretty much everybody in the world agrees on what are good qualities and what are bad qualities. Yet somehow people around the world are always disagreeing with each other. The question then follows, what are you doing to cultivate good qualities? Because we can recognize that anger is not so good. We can recognize that patience is good. But when you ask people what are they doing to cultivate patience, it doesn't occur to most people. I ask people, most people agree that compassion is a wholesome quality. You agree? It doesn't matter what religion you are, what background you are, we admire compassionate people. So my question is, what are you doing to cultivate compassion, to increase your compassion in your life? People say, well, you know, I feed my cat and I pay the taxes, that's compassion, right? So the question is, what are you doing to increase your good qualities? And what are you doing to put aside your negative qualities? And while almost everybody agrees on these qualities, good and bad, almost nobody has any answer to this question, which I find really important. And as human beings from different traditions, we should be asking this question. Up until recently, a lot of society considered that you fix these questions in society. How can I make my society better? And what you end up then with is a set of rules. And every time people get elected to office, they think up a new set of rules that they can add onto the current set of rules to make society better. And I think the English were the worst at this, but I see that they've, you know, the Pommies have been in Australia and have been tipping Australian society in the same direction. I saw that the police have been instructed to arrest and fine cyclists who don't do up the strap under their bicycle helmet. Is that going to make society a lot better? It's hard to argue against it. But when I was a kid, your mother gave you breakfast and then she put you on the bike and she shoved you out the driveway and said, you come back at dinner time. And then you just went out for the day and we all survived. We didn't even have bicycle helmets. So good and bad qualities are something that is key to understanding a spiritual practice. And by the spiritual practice, we mean rather than trying to fix society and expecting society to provide you with everything, expecting society to be perfectly fair, trying to create the perfect society which has never existed. And what happens is you get politicians who come along and change the rules every 3 or 4 years, or every 6 months in Australia, it seems. In Thailand right now, we have an army military dictatorship, and they are clamping down and putting a lot of people in prison, calling people up to what they call attitude adjustment camps, where they get threatened and their families get threatened if to make them toe the line with the military viewpoint. So you have to say things that are supportive of the military, otherwise you can go to prison. The military have just written a new constitution that will give them power over Thailand for the next 20 years. And they're putting this constitution to a referendum. And if you say anything negative about this constitution, they pass a law which says that you get 10 years in prison for saying things against the constitution that might influence another person. So that's the military's view of a great society. It's not my view. With a spiritual practice, we take the society as good enough. And especially in Australia, the society is good enough. It's pretty safe. It's pretty peaceful. Most of us have enough money. We have enough food. We have enough shelter. And we can get by reasonably well. And that's an extraordinarily privileged state for human beings to be in. If you think back or even look around many parts of the world now, many people don't have that opportunity. The space and the time that you can turn attention to your inner practice is quite rare and quite privileged. In Buddhism, we say that this human birth is very precious to use for the practice of Dharma. But even the human birth is not always that conducive. People are battling fires and floods and dictatorships and working hard to scratch a living. People face sicknesses and cancer and death and all kinds of problems. People have children. You think your parents give you trouble, wait till you have children. So the chance to practice, to have that space, have that time to be able to practice Dharma is very, very precious. So the key to practicing Dharma is this acknowledgement of good and bad qualities. But when we come to the quality of desire, this is a little more ambiguous, because most people don't list desire as something negative. In fact, if you are following the American dream, desire is the positive thing. Follow your dreams, you can do it. Anybody can become president of the United States. And that's true. Donald Trump is in with a chance. Shows anybody can do it, you know, if you have the money. So this quality of desire is very, very interesting. And we see it come up a lot in ancient literature. Next week I'm doing a talk about Pandora's box. And she opened her box and all the evil came out of the box and spread around the world. And the only thing that remained in the box was one form of desire, which is called hope. And so people have been asking this question, why was hope left in the box, but all the unwholesome qualities released to plague humankind? Shakespeare wrote a lot about desire. Recently I did the talk on The Journey to the West. Some of you will know from the Chinese backgrounds, the story of Monkey, Pigsy, Sandy, Tripitaka. Part of this is a story about desire. So when Pigsy, the horse, and Tripitaka meet with... Monkey, the horse, and Tripitaka meet Pigsy. This is a very interesting description of the nature of desire. Do you all know The Journey to the West?
Yeah.
Okay, most of you. If you want, I can afterwards... Actually, I'm going to finish a little earlier and leave more time for questions. So if you want to know more about that story, we can follow it. This quality of desire has always been intriguing. Is it good or is it bad? Because all good things in the world seem to stem from some kind of desire, some kind of motivation. Even the spiritual path, the Buddhist path, is in large part overcoming desire. And yet the Buddha said you should meditate as if your hair was on fire. That's a pretty strong desire, right? He said if your hair was on fire, you would really want to put it out. It's interesting that he knew this. I wonder if he'd seen it. If you want to see it, there's one place where you can see absolutely everything. And it's called YouTube. Yeah. Type into YouTube, hair on fire. And it's amazing how many people have set their hair on fire on camera and uploaded it to YouTube. It's just amazing. And you see the desperation that they, you know, they don't hang around and ask questions. They want to put out that flame. The Buddha said that's how you should be doing your practice. Now that implies a very strong desire, right? That's not being peaceful, man, and chill out and let go. That's really setting forth an aspiration. In Buddhism, we separate different kinds of desire. So there is sense desire. You want to get something to eat. You want to get something to smell. You want to get something to feel, something to see, or you want to get some nice idea to think about. And these are your sense desires. And sense desires in Buddhism are not considered to be good. On the other hand, you have aspirations. The Pali word is dhammacanda. And aspirations mean the aspiration for something that's good. So this kind of desire is something that we can set forth. So why is desire considered to be, or craving, tanha, is considered to be the cause of suffering in the Four Noble Truths? First Noble Truth is suffering. Suffering is to be understood. Second Noble Truth is the arising of suffering. What is the arising of suffering? It's craving that lingers here and there, according to the sutta. And that suffering needs to be put away. That desire needs to be put away or destroyed. What is the third noble truth? That is the cessation of suffering, and that needs to be made true. And what is the fourth noble truth? Is the path to the cessation of suffering, and the path is to be developed. So this is your basic format of the Four Noble Truths, which remains the cornerstone of all forms of Buddhism in the world. So this second noble truth, the desire that lingers here and there, why does desire get such a bad rap? Don't you desire to pass your exams? Don't you desire to get a good job? Don't you desire to look after your parents or your children? Or if not your parents or children, at least your cat. You must desire to look after your cat, at least. We have all these desires. Why are desires considered to be a bad thing? The nature of desire is such that it gives us a moment of happiness. And the research shows that the highest moment of happiness that you can get is just before you get what you want. So if you get yourself a new car, I don't know what cars you like these days, Porsche, I don't know. Just before you get your car, just as you're about to buy it, that's the most happy that you can be in that particular story. From the moment you get your car, the desire starts to decline. And the nature of desire is such that it follows the law of diminishing marginal returns. Are there any economists here? Anybody studying economics? No? No. Economics was my star subject when I was at school. The law of diminishing marginal returns means that if you get something and you get a reward from that, but the next time you get that thing, the reward lessens, and the next time the reward lessens, and the next time the reward lessens. For example, right now you're sitting here. Have you had dinner yet? Most of you not had dinner yet. So if I pass out a chocolate, is that nice? Do you enjoy the chocolate, a little chocolate if I give you? Yeah, you enjoy that. Okay, so I give you another one. Do you enjoy the second one? Okay, I give you another one. Do you enjoy the third one? Somebody's starting to feel like, okay, I give you a fourth chocolate. Now how much do you enjoy it? Okay, I give you 20 chocolates and I make you eat them. Now that chocolate is suffering. It's awful, right? This is the law of diminishing marginal returns. So that whatever desire that you can satisfy, you will immediately lessen the satisfaction that comes from that if you repeat the action. And this is why desire is something that can't be sated. And no matter what you do, you will never achieve or attain to happiness through desire. Because your desire, your happiness from that thing will lessen every time. Do people understand this? Not so much. You see, people that hammer away trying to get the things that they desire over and over and over again. And the people who do so lead increasingly unhappy lives. One real life example, for most guys who like girls, you see a girl, very beautiful, you're like, oh, I love her so much, send her some flowers, oh baby, I love you, this kind of thing. And then she says, okay, and you get together. And then immediately the guy's like, oh, there's another girl over there. So, for some, I had this one friend at school, and we admired him because he could always get girls. He was a master at his trade. But as life went on, as he got through his 20s and into his 30s and then into his 40s, and still he would jump from girl to girl to girl. And our admiration for him lessened and lessened and lessened, because everybody else was growing up and starting to realize that simply getting what you want is not going to make you happy. But a stable relationship with somebody good and somebody decent, that's worth cherishing and that's worth working on. And that's worth giving up other desires for. Every man and every girl also, you know, your desires will wander off onto other people, you get crushes and things like this. But for most humans, we recognize that following desires at first seems like fun. But the people who do that, they turn out to be really not worthwhile people. There is, talking of Porsches, there is one comedian. You know, sometimes I mention people and things and I expect everybody to know, and then they say that they don't know. I said to somebody, I mentioned Star Wars the other day, and somebody said, oh, I've never seen it. I'm like, I want to stop the car and beat you. You've all seen Star Wars, right? The original Star Wars?
Yeah.
No? So, my question is, do you know Jerry Seinfeld?
Yeah.
You know Jerry Seinfeld? Okay, he was a comedian, stand-up comedian, and by chance, he got the opportunity to write a TV series for a TV network in America, a sitcom. And weirdly, the TV station said he can write whatever he wants. And if any of you are into writing, you will know that American TV especially follows a tried and tested formula. And there has to be certain elements and certain... especially the key people in the sitcom have to have a conflict with each other, which sets up an interesting situation. And Seinfeld said, and his co-writer Larry David said, we are going to write our sitcom about nothing. And they were very proud of this. And for the first three seasons, they just about managed to get renewed each season. It was very unpopular. Not many people watched it. By the fourth season, it got very, very popular. And by the fifth and sixth season, it was just massive. And I think Seinfeld ran for 9 seasons. It's well worth watching if you haven't seen it. It's a good series. 7 seasons. So, by season number 4, because it was doing well, Jerry Seinfeld, the writer, started to get paid more money. And by the end of the season, he was up to $1 million per episode. And there were 26 episodes in the season. Plus, that was as a writer. As an actor, he got paid more, because he acted in it also. So what does Jerry Seinfeld do when he starts getting his money? And he's a nice guy. I'm not blaming him at all. he'd always had this fascination with Porsches. You know, a Porsche, the car. Some people say Porsche, some people say Porsche. And so after he started to earn his money, he managed to buy himself a classic Porsche. Happiness, bliss. And as the season went on, well, that's only one episode. He was churning out an episode a week. And one episode $1 million. He could buy a Porsche every week. So he buys two. And then he buys four. And then there are several Porsches of different classical eras. So he buys 10. And he got all the way up to 90 before he started to realize that buying more cars is not making him more happy. Now, I don't blame him. He's a nice guy. He earned his money in a good way. He has a right to spend it on Porsches if he wishes. I'm sure he did good things with his money also. So, in no way blaming him. At the time when he had 30 or so of these cars, he was building his house. I think it was on Manhattan Island. And to store all these cars, he built an underground garage. And this was a huge, you know, to store 30 cars, that's a big hole that you've got to dig in the ground under your house, right? But as he was building his house, he got more and more of these cars. So he had to build a bigger and bigger hole in the ground, dig this big hole. And eventually the town and county planners came to inspect his property, and they saw this vast cavern that he'd hollowed out under Manhattan Island and said, hang on a minute, you don't have permission for this. You've got to fill it in. So then he spent a huge amount of money buying earth and trucking it in to fill in this hole that he had dug in the ground. And it was at that point that he started to recognize that buying more Porsches is not going to make him happier. Why does it take 90 cars? I can't remember the exact number, but it was around the 100 mark. And not just Porsches, he had some other classic cars also. Why does he get to that? You can only drive one car at a time, right? And you've got to clean them and wash them and license them. Imagine buying the car insurance just for 90 cars. He must have a secretary that just works on car documentation. And then they need servicing. I mean, it's insane, right? And this is the nature of desire, that it feels good. So much so that we are unaware of the point of diminishing marginal returns. We're unaware of the fact that this desire, the desires that we have when we follow, start to cause us suffering. And we don't notice it. Because there's always a little marginal buzz of getting one extra thing. Jerry Seinfeld eventually sold off a number of his cars. I believe he has about 50. So, real renunciate. And he has, after the Seinfeld TV series, which was so massive that he was a little overawed by himself, and he didn't want to do anything else because it would never match what he had done previously. So he did low-key things, and now he has a YouTube channel, Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. Has anybody seen that? Nobody has seen that? Okay, it's quite good. And what he does is he goes to get one of his classic cars, and he'll go and pick up a famous comedian, and they'll drive somewhere and get coffee. Now, if you've collected all these cars, you've got to do something with them. So this is his one and only way to show off his cars and try to eke out a bit more pleasure in the cars. Interestingly, that to get pleasure out of the cars, he has to show them to other people, right? It's only by sharing the joy that you can increase the happiness. he did one of these with Obama, which was quite interesting. So he picked up Obama, and then they go driving off. But interestingly, Obama is not allowed outside of the White House without bulletproof car and guards and things. So Obama gets through the gate, and they say, "Sorry, Mr. President, we won't allow you out." So this is the nature of desire, in that it doesn't help. It doesn't give you this endless return of happiness. So how can you practically, for most of you, you're not going to give up all desire. And if you try, you can't. Can't do it. I tried once. And it was in a temple, and we had these all-night meditation sessions. 7 p.m. till 6 a.m. in the morning, sitting meditation, all night long. You're allowed to get up and you're allowed to walk, but you're not allowed to let your shoulders touch the ground. Right? So we mastered the art of sleeping over a chair and all kinds of all kinds of things like this, devious ways. And I said, right, if desire is the cause of suffering, I will sit here on this seat and I will overcome all desire. I will not get up out of this seat until the end of the session, 6 o'clock in the morning. Resolute. May my bones turn to dust. May my blood dry up. You know the vow of the Buddha when he was getting enlightened? I will sit under this Bodhi tree and my bones will turn to dust, but I will not move until I gain enlightenment. Well, I set my sights a bit lower. I said, I will not move until 6 a.m. For the first hour, for the second hour, for the third hour, and by around the third hour, I'm thinking, you know, I really want to pee. Desire is causing suffering. I'm like, yeah, but like, I need a pee, man. And so I thought, well, I'll give myself permission to go to the bathroom. And then the third time I went to the bathroom that hour, I took an extra walk around on the, I thought I'll walk around the long way. And then, you know, I started to, you can't overcome desire. It's what I learned on that night. You set forth your ego. Your ego is not strong enough. You're not powerful enough. Can't do it. Now, the times that I have found, because part of the title here is how to feel rich about it. The times that I noticed that I had the best pleasure ever. Think about it for yourself. When was the time? When was the best pleasure that you ever had? Keep it clean. What was the best sensory experience you ever had? I have a couple that I can relate to you. One of them was, I went to see Shakespeare in Stratford-on-Avon, which is where Shakespeare is from, and they have a theatre there. Very prestigious theatre. A lot of great actors have been through that theatre. And there is a rule, one special rule in Stratford with performances of Shakespeare. That is, you do not go to the bathroom during a performance. And they let you know this before you go. It's very, very clear. They make it very clear to you. Now, when I went, I was in the sixth form, which is means I was like 17, 18. But we went with a group of the fifth formers who were like 15, 16. And we got there an hour or so early. So all the fifth formers, all the young guys, they had to go around and do this tour, reading the plaques here. Shakespeare was born in this house and his wife was born in that house, and this is where he got married, and this is where he wrote the play. And they had to do the cultural tour, But for the four of us who were in the sixth form, we went straight to the pub. And we only had an hour. That's enough time for three games of pool and two pints of beer. Look at our watch. Damn, it's about to start. Run into the theatre, just in time, sit down, the performance starts. Two pints of beer does not take very long to filter its, percolate its way down before it's starting to call for your attention. And the four of us were sitting here like that. We just, our suffering was increasing exponentially by the minute. And this went on. I lasted about an hour and a half. I'm quite proud of that. And just could not take any more. And I got up and made my way out through the thing. And you know what they do? If you move, or you're not supposed to eat toffees or popcorn or anything during Shakespeare as well. And if you move or rustle a toffee wrapper, the attendant comes and he shines his torch on you like this. And then you're like zapped with a lightsaber. Like, you know. That's if you undo a toffee wrapper. I was making my way out for the bathroom. Three or four of these torches start lighting up on me like this. And I swear, I just did not care. I just... And I get to the bathroom, I just clearly remember this because I don't know, most guys will know this. If you've been holding on a long time, it takes a while to let it go. And I was lying there, my head on the bathroom wall. And a guard comes in and he says, "You do not go to the toilet during Shakespeare." And I was just like, "I just don't care. I just don't care what you say." And the waves of bliss that came over me. That's just about the happiest experience, sensory experience that I've ever had. It was so wonderful. What makes that experience so wonderful is the renunciation. The more you hold yourself in restraint of sense desires, the happier those things are when you participate in them. And I found this time and time again. Another time I was in Singapore and I was going to a meeting by this famous Rinpoche who I know, and I decided like an idiot that I was going to walk. And Singapore is not designed for people to walk, and the footpaths don't connect. And regularly I found myself like walking in ditches by the side of the road and crossing motorways which had no bridges, because in Singapore, if you walk anywhere more than 5 minutes, you're considered insane. And I didn't have any money, didn't take anything to drink, I just didn't think about it, basically. And when I got there to the thing, which was about 4.5 hours, dying of thirst. And when I got there, they said, "Oh, didn't you know? It's cancelled." I'd just done this huge pilgrimage. And so I get back and I look in my bag. I had a little bit of money and just enough. And I saw this shop, this Indian shop. And I went into this Indian shop and I had a lassi. I had just enough coins in my bag to buy a lassi. And that was the most sweet, beautiful drink I've ever had in my life. In fact, it was years after that I wouldn't touch another lassi because I was afraid it would interfere with my memory of that beautiful, beautiful drink. Why? Because of the renunciation. Because I'd gone without that thing, then when I do get it, it's so much more beautiful, so much more happy. I know that if I'd had two lasses, it wouldn't be as good. If I'd had three, and if I got to my fourth one, I'd be like, "No, take it away." Right? So the answer to this question on the board, in my experience, is to practice renunciation. And notice that the Buddha, in his teachings, he didn't really tell people that you have to overcome desire with your ego. He didn't tell people to, you know, fight and to struggle. He told people to hold themselves in restraint. And it's very interesting. You will never overcome desire, because that's desire fighting against desire. That's you fighting against you. And the stronger you make yourself, the stronger the enemy is that you're trying to overcome. So logically, it won't work. There are many stories about warriors who are equal in strength and power fighting each other. The one that springs to mind, Achilles and Hector, they were both in the Trojan War, and they were both evenly matched warriors, and neither could destroy the other. Achilles cheated because he was indestructible, but this is where we get Achilles' heel from. And this motif in stories of two equals fighting each other means this is you fighting against yourself. And the stronger you make yourself, the stronger the thing is that you're fighting. So the Buddha did not recommend this at all. He recommended restraint. And restraint means that you don't have to destroy the desire, but you hold yourself in restraint. And the more restraints that you have, the happier and more beautiful things are when you experience them. Our monk's life is like this. We get the best of things and we get the worst of things. In Thailand, on special days, they very often have a lot of people come to the temple, and they all offer lots and lots of food. And people take pictures of like a monk sitting there with a vast sea of food around him. And then they show a picture of a beggar. And they like to juxtapose these pictures and say, look at these monks. And that food should go to the beggar. These monks are no good. Believe me, a vast sea of food is not what we ask for or desire. And it's not even that much fun, really. On other days, sometimes the people who are supposed to feed you don't turn up, and you get nothing. Many a days I've gone without food. In fact, early in my monastic tradition career, I went on a couple of 6-day fasts, not eating for 6 days, to teach myself that I don't need to eat, and that eating really isn't a source of happiness. It's something you just do every day. So I learned to be able to live without. So that restraint that we have means that when you do get something as a monk, we get fed something we like, we enjoy it that much more. And monks are usually very happy people, happier than regular people. The reason we have that happiness is the practice of restraint. Unbridled desire has this law of diminishing marginal returns. Practicing restraint opens you up because you're willing to experience things that you don't expect, things that you don't like, or you think you don't like, maybe you do like them, etc. So, this is the trick in answer to the question of how to spend money and feel rich about it in terms of desire. Ultimately, all desire, if you look into the nature of desire itself, desire is a form of suffering. Desire is a feeling that you lack something. Right? And that if you get that thing, then you will be complete. So in psychology, desire is considered to be a stressor. And this is what motivation is about. You get stressed and you want to eliminate that stress to find happiness. So, for example, if you ever smoked cigarettes, I smoked cigarettes for nearly 20 years. It's been over a decade since I smoked, and you know you're crazy if you smoke, but, you know, to smokers, we like it. And then I would notice that I thought I liked smoking, but when you analyze it, what you're really doing is you're having an agitation of, I need a cigarette. And you're eliminating the discomfort by having a cigarette. So when you look closely at the nature of desire, in actual fact, it's not even that pleasant. It's simply removing a stressor. One other way to remove a stressor, is not to feed it with more thinking. And any desire that comes up is fed by thinking. And Sakha, the lord of the king of the gods in the realm of the 33, I think it was the Tavatimsa heaven. The story goes that the Buddha met this king of the gods, Sakha. And Sakha asked, wherein is it that this desire arises? And the Buddha said, desire, king of the gods, is led by thinking. So when you dwell on something, dwell with your attention and your thoughts, desire will start to arise. If you don't dwell on something, those desires will fade away. I get this when I go past a computer shop, because I like computers, and I always want a new computer. And if I go to the shop and I look at them, I'm like, I like this. And then I'm like, I need this. And then I'm like, I've got to have this. And then I start to get a bit wary of, like, is this sense desire? And I'm like, no, this is so that I can do a website and put Dharma on it, and that will help people. That's why I need the computer. Desire will put this little lawyer on your shoulder. Nobody's studying law here, right? This little lawyer appears on your shoulder and says, yeah, but you really need this thing. It's not a selfish thing. It's for the goodness of humanity if you have this thing. And then I stop and I really think, reflect, this desire is just coming up because I've put my mind onto that object. What if I just put my mind somewhere else? I think about something else and the desire for that thing disappears. Then you come to see the ending of desire. And when you see the ending of desire, you start to get power over your desires. And as a monk, people come to me with different problems. And always the problems people have stem from desire. If people knew the practice of seeing the ending of desires, they would not be pushed and pulled around by their desires. When you have the freedom from desire then, which is what we practice as monks, the beauty of it is you have space. I have space with my attention. Now I can stop and I can reflect. What is it that I'm trying to get to see, to smell, to taste, to touch, to feel, to think about? What qualities is that going to increase? Is that going to increase my negative qualities of greed and hatred and desire and anger and jealousy? Or I can put my attention onto something that is a real aspiration. And that way then I can set forth a motivation to do something that I think is worthwhile or that I think is good. So, this is the, in response to the title, my response is an inquiry into the nature of desire itself. To see that desire has this law of diminishing marginal returns. to see that there are different aspirations, aspirations that increase good qualities or increase negative qualities. You can't overcome desire by desire, by ego. You can only overcome desire by restraint. Restraint opens up that space. When then you know that desire is not going to overpower you, then you can turn your attention to doing what you think is a good aspiration that's going to increase your good qualities. Okay? So that neatly brought us back, 8:29 on the dot. So we have a little bit of time for if you have any questions. Now, some of the questions are in the box, but you're welcome also to ask if you have questions. Could be anything in there. Okay, if it's answered, pick, take another one.
There's only one.
Okay, so if you have a question or if you'd like me to talk about something else, then something more, something that I touched on today.
Tell us a bit more about the journey to the West that you're talking about.
The journey to the West.
Just the bit about desire that you mentioned.
Okay. The Journey to the West, the writer was commissioned to write a work about, Journey to the West is one of the two or four great Chinese classics of literature. I know next to nothing about Chinese literature, I have to say. The other classic was The Water Margin, and I watched the whole series, but beyond that I can't comment. He was commissioned to write about Buddhism. And he went off and spent years writing this huge, huge book. It's like the English version is 4,000 pages, 2,000 pages. Even I haven't read it all, and I like it. When he came back with a story about a monkey spirit and a pig spirit and a sand spirit and a horse and a monk. And he was basically ridiculed for writing this nonsense fairy tale. But when you're writing about internal qualities, everything internally happens in paradox. The more you give away, the more you have. The more you give up desire, the happier you feel, etc. So everything internally always happens in a paradox. The more you strive to get to the goal, the further away the goal becomes. So in order to understand the paradoxical nature of the mind, what most writers have done throughout the ages, Old Testament, modern day movies, they take the different internal elements and they make them into a character. And the interplay between the characters is the interplay of your own psyche. And good stories are done that way. This went on for a millennia, but unfortunately was ruined by Shakespeare. Now, are there any English lit students here who are going to beat me for criticizing Shakespeare? I really don't like Shakespeare. Because he turned the narrative into an external tale of people and getting interacting in society and doing things, and he set forth modern literature along that path. But you know, the older stories were always stories of internal battles. Now, where in the Journey to the West was the story vaguely based upon the story of two Chinese monks who are real Chinese monks. I'm not going to tell you their names because anybody who speaks Chinese will come and beat me for mispronouncing their names. But there were two real monks who went over to India to collect the Buddhist sutras and take them back to China. So the story is loosely based on this idea, and the travelers go off from China. Now, I'm going to presume that for the people who know the story, if you don't know the story, you might get a little bit lost here, but it should be okay. Where we come across desire in the story is the monk and the horse. The monk represents the ego. The horse represents thinking. He's often called the thought horse in the story. Monkey, his name means mind attained to emptiness. So the three of them are travelling, and they come to a village, and they meet a person in the village who says this village is being terrorized by a demon. And Monkey says, I'm pretty good at handling demons, bit of fun along the way, you know, show him to me. And the story goes that this demon had turned up in the town, and the head townsman had three daughters, and two daughters he married off, and they went to nice homes and families. But the third daughter, he wanted to stay. So he wanted to find a nice bachelor to marry his third daughter. And this handsome young man comes along and says that he has nowhere to live. And the man says, great, marry my daughter. Notice how he, you know, never asks the daughter what she thinks. But and he was a great provider. He worked, he didn't need oxen to tug the plough. He planted the crops with his bare hands. He harvested the crops with his bare hands. He was an incredible worker. He made more and more fields. He built walls. He built aqueducts. And he brought in lots and lots of food. But he ate more and more and more food. Every year that went by, he would eat vast quantities of grain and goods. Furthermore, he took the daughter and he locked her up in a room out the back. And so eventually, Monkey and this, and as the story goes on, he gets more and more ugly. He grew bigger and bigger ears, his nose turned into a snout, and he became like a pig. So this is the story of desire. Desire is needed if you want to organize the society around you. If you want to do good things and feed yourself and your family, you need desire. So desire is very good at plowing the fields and getting in the grain. But the more desire is unrestrained, the more and more ugly the person who has desire becomes. Desires will envelop a person, will chain them, will make them more ugly and more selfish. So he becomes more and more ugly and turns into a pig. And the girl represents the highest aspiration, the sweet and the beautiful side of the psyche. And she gets locked away in a room at the back, which means you may start out with a nice desire and a beautiful psyche, but what will happen is the desire turns into a pig, and the beautiful aspect of your mind gets locked away in the back of the mind. Now, Monkey is attained to emptiness, and emptiness can go anywhere. So Monkey is the only one that can break into the room at the back. So he lets the girl go, and he changes himself into a girl, and the pig spirit arrives in this great wind that rips the town apart, pulls the tiles off the roofs, and he comes in this huge storm. Desire is never quiet. Once it's picked up its speed, it's noisy, it's destructive. And most importantly, it comes with a fog, because when there is desire, you can't see clearly. So he comes with this fog, and he meets with Monkey in this back room, but it's dark. And he jumps on Monkey, who is transformed into the shape of this girl. And he says, come on, darling, give me a kiss. And Monkey gives him a slap and pushes him off and jumps up, pulls down his pants. And Pixie says, what are you doing, my darling? And Monkey says, I'm taking a shit. This is the word that they use, so I'm just quoting. Why is he doing that? Because the mind attained to emptiness is nonchalant in the face of desire. Even this great storm of desire, if you can see that emptiness in the mind, that emptiness is completely nonchalant and is not overpowered by the nature of desire. So much so is he not overpowered by desire, he can just go to the toilet. Then ensues this great battle, and the pixie and monkey are evenly matched. However, pixie will grow tired and monkey will never grow tired, because monkey requires no desire. The mind attains to emptiness, which, by the way, is a source of immense creativity and immense power and immense joy. But that is a happiness that is not coming at an expense of tiredness. So the energy to do the right thing and the good thing through the empty mind, the energy will increase. The energy to do things through desire, your energy will decrease. So Pigsy eventually locks himself away in his mountain. Monkey goes back, checks that the monkey's okay and the horse is okay. And then they come back and they're going to fight again. And Pigsy says, like, why do you keep picking on me? And Monkey says, well, I'm with my master, we're going off to the east. And Pigsy says, why didn't you say so? I'd been told that you were going to pass by and I have to join you on your trip and help you. And then the pig spirit says, tie my hands behind my back and take me to your master. And so this is the restraint of desire. Notice that desire is not killed in this story. It's not overcome. Desire is transformed into something that's useful. And this is a common motif in all the stories that talk about desire. Samson, Delilah, if you want to know that one, I don't think we quite have enough time. We can come back. Other stories, Parsifal, Wagner's opera, have this same motif, that desire needs to be restrained, not killed. Do you all remember that part of the Journey to the West? You remember that story where they meet Pigsy? Not really. I was a fan. I got into it through the Japanese version. I thought the Japanese TV version was the best of the Journey to the West. Anybody else? If nobody has any questions, does that mean I've done a very good job or a very bad job? Does that mean you're all understanding and inspired, or does that mean you're all asleep and like...
I really
like
the story. It's good.
And again, if you're going to do your play, I have several of these stories which you can choose from, but are stories about the practice and often classic stories. So we can do this as a play and really, you know, I can write a few papers, we can have some discussion groups. And when somebody points out what the stories mean, they become very, very, very clear. Yeah, go ahead.
I have a question about desire. You said you can overcome your desire. And then you said that the desire can blind you because some temporary activation. And then, so do you mean that you need someone to remind you about the desire because you cannot overcome desire yourself?
Okay, so there's two points to your question. The first point is that desire fogs the faculties. In Buddhism, the cause of the whole chain that leads into suffering is avijja, not knowing. So this is the fog of delusion. In the Christian mystics, they also said the devil always comes in a fog. And God always comes in light. And the devil will maintain this fog to keep people in delusion. So desire will cloud your faculties so that you can't see properly. And when you get caught up, people can justify absolutely anything through, if that's what they want, through desire. And people do not act rationally or clearly when they're overcome by desire. So all desire has this faculty that it will fog you. In Samson and Delilah, which is also a story of desire, after Samson is overpowered by Delilah, she cuts his hair. When she cuts his hair, she takes away his energy. When his energy is gone, he's captured. And the first thing they do is they pluck out his eyes. Second thing they do is they chain him to a wheel, a grinding wheel, to put him to work. So, in the Old Testament, desire has the quality that it takes out your eyes, it chains you, and it puts you to work. So, all through literature, we have these motifs that desire is something that, even though it's needed to do good things, it's something that will lead you into bad things. The point about overcoming desire is you can't set up one part of you that defeats the other part of you. So, for example, you set the alarm clock. I'm going to get up at 4:30 in the morning and I'm going to do an hour and a half of meditation. That's one part of you. And the other part of you is at 4:30 in the morning. Like, yeah, you must be joking. One part of you against the other part of you. This is using your ego to fight your ego, yourself to fight yourself, your desires to fight your desires. And this gets more and more difficult. But there is that knack of restraint. When you know the restraint of desire, you see the freedom from desire. Remember, monkey in the story, he's free from desire. Even if desires are going on, there's that part of you that can see it and recognize it. That's the part that will enable you to overcome desire, not the ego, not the other, not more desire. So seeing through the nature of desire through restraint. The whole monk's life is about restraint, you know, our rules and regulations. Go ahead.
You mentioned sort of a recollection of you're walking past a computer store, you wanted to get something, it became a desire. Obviously, although with, I guess, technology is a bit of a different scenario because it keeps on moving, but obviously we can put off that desire through restraint. At what point does it then become, I guess, a bit justified to acknowledge that desire as it becomes a bit more of a requirement, as it were?
Basically, you want to buy your computer.
Sort of, yes.
Right. I have noticed in my own life that any desires that I have, I can put down. And if I find myself getting overpowered by a desire, I can see it and I put it down. Later on, then I will decide in a cooler, calmer, more rational moment if I need to do that or not. So there are some things. I mean, we all act from desire. I've come to Australia. I desired to escape the heat of Bangkok. When I came, I told them I'm happy to do talks and things, desire to come out and talk with people. I'm happy to do that. I think that's a good thing. That's a worthy thing. I can practice my public speaking. So in the cooler and calmer moments, you decide on the aspiration. But desires will tend to lean into those negative aspects, whereas aspirations will tend to increase those good aspects. So ask yourself the question, by following this desire and thing, am I increasing in good qualities or am I increasing in the negative qualities? And you've got to be practical. I just got this big phone. It's not an iPhone. I think they copied the design, but it's like one quarter the price of an iPhone. and twice as good. But I got this because my eyes are, you know, I'm 47, my eyes are not as good as they used to be, and I can't see, and I just thought, you get a big phone, I can see it more clearly. So, you know, you've got to be practical. Yeah. Go ahead.
Is there any desire that is actually pure and wholesome? For example, your desire to be enlightened, or is it the opposite, you need to let go in order to achieve enlightenment?
Ultimately, for enlightenment, when you get the glimpses of enlightenment, it's those moments when the mind has completely come together. Some people only notice this once, twice, or three times in a lifetime. Some people only see this very commonly when they're drowning, or when they're dying, or when they're in extreme crisis, and they get this glimpse. And it's the point where the mind has nowhere left to go. There's a Zen koan. A man sits on the top of a 100-foot pole. How does he proceed? That's the koan. And the point of the koan is not to answer the question. The point of the koan is to attain to that insight. This is talking about the mind. There's a point in the mind where it has nowhere left to go. It can't go forward, it can't go back, it can't go up, it can't go down. That moment, all desires cease, because desire can only arise when the mind is moving. When the mind stops moving, all desire stops. And it's in those moments that you see the path. Now, does that then set forth a desire to do the practice? Yes, that's an aspiration. And without an aspiration, you won't develop. So, there's this twin aspect.
I'm still trying to distinguish the difference between fighting desire with desire and also restraint. So, previously you mentioned that to fight desires with restraint, and also it's about trying to think about something else. And so once your mind is not on that thing, you won't have the desire for it.
Okay. Can you desire anything that you're not thinking about?
No.
Okay. So desire will only arise when there's thinking about that thing.
So,
can you have desire that is there when you are not thinking about it? This is a serious question, and for me as a psychologist, we would actually say yes, you can. In your unconscious, you can have desires, but in Buddhist terms, we don't. So this is a really interesting question, and when I come back next year, we can do this as a topic. So, the point is that with the restraints, you can see the ending of desires. And normally, desire fogs because you feel that the only way to get past the stressor of desire is to get the object of your desire. And actually, that's not true. You can get past that desire simply by turning and looking at something else. But the insight comes when you see the end of the desire, when you see it cease. Then you know that that desire does not have power over you.
But then, so, for example, like, for the last week or so, I've been going, okay, I should not have any chocolate, so I don't have any chocolates. But
right.
Then, because I'm not having any chocolates, then sometimes my mind would think about having chocolate.
More.
And so how do you...
Who here thinks that he's really talking about chocolate?
Yeah.
Okay, but there's a mistake that you're making there, is that we view the world philosophically of I have my desires for this, and I have chocolate, and I have all these things juggling around. That's actually not true or real. And to a meditator, you trade that view of the world The only thing that is real is what is arising right now. So, right now, you're having a cup of tea and you're not thinking about chocolate. That desire for chocolate is gone. Now, normally you think to yourself, well, I have the desire for chocolate the whole time, or whatever it is that you're really talking about, the whole time. But actually you don't. It's only there when you're putting conscious thought and attention onto it. So as a meditator, we don't want to solve the problems in the world and chocolate and food and diets and exercise and walking 10,000 steps a day. And what we are interested in is that one experience that's arising right now. So when that experience arises, you can feel it. Oh, chocolate. You recognize that 5 seconds before that, you weren't desiring that chocolate. You hold it there, you let it be there in your mind, and it will like, think about me, think about me, think about me. And you're like, nah. And then it goes, no, and it wanders off. And then you experience freedom from that desire, like it's gone. 10 seconds ago I really needed it, and now it's gone. That's the insight. And that starts to give you confidence that you can operate outside of your desires and not be pushed and pulled around by your desires. Don't worry if that desire is going to come back. That's not your problem. To a meditator, we're interested in that one experience as it arises and as it disappears. Most people never stay with an experience until it disappears. They only see experiences arising. And then you assume that that's always been there. You assume that, oh, I've been wanting this chocolate for 3 weeks. No, you haven't. It's just arisen, and it's just about to cease. So that's the meditation way of dealing with it. There are other systems and other formats. I'm not offering this as ultimate truth. I'm offering this as a way of Dharma. Certainly in psychology, there are other ways to deal with desires and other ways to think about desires that are valid and are useful. We're just about out of time. I hope that you've all been entertained a little bit. We've laughed a bit. Go ahead.
Sorry, just one more question. By being enlightened, we talk about complete cessation of desire. But you mentioned how desire can't be overcome. Does that mean, like, when you become enlightened, does that mean, like, your mind is empty, and completely empty, or what do you call that? Ubeka?
Okay. But remember, everything works in paradox. When the mind is completely empty, it's totally fulfilled. Everything works in paradox as you go inwards. So I can't really tell you about the enlightened mind. I can give you theories, I can give you teachings from different teachers, but the path seems to be, in one sentence, the mind starts to see something over and above or outside of its own self and its own thoughts. When it sees that, it jumps away from the senses and rests in that experience. So the enlightened people, they say, well, my mind never moves. Nothing could ever harm me because my mind will never move from its own source. But we're getting very deep. Okay, that's for the year after. Next year, we'll do that one. Okay, I hope you've all had an interesting time. It's a privilege to come and talk to you all. We've laughed a bit, we've thought about a bit, we've had one question in the question box. So, thank you for having me, and hope to see you again at some point.